Strong, and this is VOA 1, The Hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Brian Lynn.
And I'm Katie Weaver. This program is aimed at English learners. So we speak slowly, and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. Today on the show, we have reports from Jill Robbins and John Russell. Anna Mateo brings us words and their stories, and Andrew Smith presents Ask a Teacher. We close the show with an American story. Now, here is John Russell.
For tens of thousands of men in Uganda's capital, driving a motorcycle taxi is a way to make a living. For others, the vehicles known as bodabodas are a necessary but dangerous form of transportation in a disorderly city. The young men sit on motorcycles in the morning heat. When they see someone who might be a passenger, they start their machines and compete to offer the person a ride. The motorcycle taxis are everywhere in East African capitals like Nairobi and Kigali. But in Kampala, the numbers are huge. The city of 3 million people has no mass transportation system and a high rate of unemployment. There are around 350,000 bodabodas. The men driving them come from all parts of Uganda. They say there are no other jobs for them. "We just do this one because we have nothing to do," said one driver, Zuberi Idi Nyakuni. "All of us here, they have their degrees, they have their master's degrees, but they are just here. They have nothing to do." The city has tried to control them and remove them from the central business area. But it is not easy. The government fears what might happen if they anger a large group of jobless men. Charles Mpagi is a spokesperson for Tugendi, a company based in Kampala that finances bodaboda purchases. He said, "You have quite a large number of people that are young, who can't find jobs, and they do not have significant alternative income to get into other enterprises. About 76% of Uganda's 43 million people are under 35, according to government figures. There are few jobs for them. The central bank reports that just 1% of Ugandan workers make $270 or more in monthly pay. Uganda's unemployment rate for people between 18 and 30 was 17% in 2021, higher than for other age groups. For young people in urban areas, it was 19%. President Yoweri Museveni has held power since 1986. He has long welcomed the support of bodaboda men, who create a loud presence at his political rallies. Museveni has gifted bodabodas to supporters and is reducing the 3-year licensing fee from nearly $100 to about $35. Motorcycles first appeared on the Uganda-Kenya border during political instability in the 1970s. The term bodaboda comes from the way drivers used to shout "border, border" at possible customers. At the time, they were also a way to transport smugglers and their merchandise. Today, they are everywhere in Uganda, taking children to school, people to offices, the sick to clinics, and even the dead to their burials. Each year, police reports say that motorcycle taxis help carry out violent crime. The Ministry of Works and Transport also reports that the number of deadly accidents related to motorcycles across Uganda grew from 621 in 2014 to 1,404 in 2021. Road safety regulations for motorcycles were first approved in 2004. But traffic police are often unable to make arrests for motorcyclists breaking the law. They fear fights because drivers quickly come to support one another. Many Boda Boda men pay the owner of their vehicle every month. Failure to pay means the Boda Boda driver loses his job along with the motorcycle. Innocent Awita, a Boda Boda man who left school in 2008, said there was too much pressure to keep his motorcycle. He pays $4 a day and pays for fuel and repairs. Some days are better than others. But Awita said he sometimes goes without enough earnings to make the daily payment. I can work for 3 days without getting anything, but if I get something the next day, that can save my life, he said. I'm John Russell.
In the 1970s, a lack of community investment resulted in a large number of people leaving Harlem, a well-known New York City neighborhood in northern Manhattan. Nearly 50,000 people, about a third of the area's population, left to escape violence, crime, and poor living conditions. Among those who left was Lisandra Moore's mother, who moved to the state of Virginia. It was a scary time, said Moore, now 52, and still living in Harlem. I couldn't blame her for that. Those who stayed were mostly poor black families. They lived through unrest that followed the 1964 killing of an unarmed black teenager and the killings of black leader Malcolm X in 1965 and Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. News reports described Harlem as a sinking ship. Percy Sutton was president of the local Manhattan government at the time. As the city's highest-ranking black official, he knew Harlem needed a lift and started a festival called Harlem Day in 1974. Sutton called up elected officials. He gathered actors like Sidney Poitier and Ruby Dee, entertainers including Tito Puente and Max Roach, and the poet Maya Angelou to celebrate the first Harlem Day. It honored Harlem's history and shows how the neighborhood became known as Black Mecca, or the center of black arts, culture, and businesses. It was such a successful day, said Lloyd Williams, one of Harlem Day's co-founders and the current president of the Greater Harlem Chamber of Commerce, that it became a week-long yearly event called Harlem Week. This year, Harlem Week celebrated its 50th anniversary, with 18 days filled with free programming. The celebration included food, Broadway performances, an Apollo Hour, and a tribute to entertainer Harry Belafonte. It offered financial education and career training, and for children, back-to-school backpacks. One important part of Harlem Week was an effort to deal with Harlem's long-standing health crises. Medical volunteers checked blood pressure and tested for cancer and diabetes. People learned about drug use, HIV/AIDS, and healthy aging. Reverend Al Sharpton leads the National Action Network in Harlem. He said, Harlem Week has been the constant line through the last 50 years of America's most historic black neighborhood. Organizers and people say Harlem Week has brought new life to the area. The once deserted neighborhood is now home to restored buildings, new businesses, and immigrants. The streets are filled with jazz, reggae, R&B, and gospel music traditions. Moore, the Harlem native whose mother moved to Virginia, watched as big national stores moved in. Sometimes they took the place of local shops and made rents go up. Some of that is okay, but what about the small business where you can get that great sandwich? She asked. Moore wants people to eat less fast food, so she teaches healthy eating and cooking to young local students. At Harlem Week, Moore represented Girl Trek, a national movement of black women supporting health through walking. She said, "I feel like I should have left a long time ago, but something about Harlem draws me back to it." Moore continued, "Harlem is my beginning. Harlem is my future. Harlem is a huge part of what makes me who I am." I'm Jill Robbins.
Hello. This week on Ask a Teacher, we answer a question from Aaron Ali in Sudan about how to become a fluent speaker. Dear teacher, I have been learning English since 2010, but I can't speak English fluently, even now. Could you tell me how to get my English fluent? Thank you for writing to us, Aaron Ali. I'm happy to answer this question. To help you reach your goal, consider the following two questions. 1. What is making it difficult for you to become fluent? 2. Are you getting the input and practice with English that you need? Input means the language that you listen to and read. Being fluent does not mean speaking a language without any mistakes. Instead, fluency is the ability to speak without stopping too much. It is also the ability to speak about a large number of issues. Try to identify what is preventing you from being fluent. Maybe you worry about making grammar mistakes. Maybe pronunciation problems slow you down. Perhaps you simply might not know enough words. Or you might need more confidence or belief in yourself. If that is the case, our VOA Learning English article linked here gives advice for gaining more confidence in your speaking. People generally need two things to become fluent. The first thing they need is to know a lot of words and expressions. You should listen to and read English that you can mostly understand, but that also helps you learn a few new expressions at a time. Remember, you can be fluent even if you make many grammar mistakes. But you cannot speak fluently if you do not know enough words and expressions. The second thing learners need is a lot of practice speaking in different kinds of situations. Try to find an English-speaking partner and practice often. Online sites can help you find a language partner. You can have a conversation with this person over a mobile phone or computer. And this VOA Learning English article gives advice for great language exchanges. Practice speaking about particular topics. For example, if you are interested in health and exercise, learn the words and expressions connected to that topic. Next, try to write about it. Writing can help you organize your ideas and remember vocabulary. Last, practice speaking about the topic using the special vocabulary you have learned. Storytelling is another way to practice. It helps you learn expressions and grammatical forms. Tell a story many times. That will help you feel what it is like to speak fluently. Reading out loud is another way to practice. And the video and article linked here gives advice about doing that. Finally, our How to Pronounce series shows you how to say common phrases quickly and easily. For our readers and listeners, do you have a question about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Andrew Smith.
And now, words and their stories from VOA Learning English. Today, we talk about an important time in a movement or experience. It is the moment when something cannot be stopped. There is a momentum or force pushing something forward, or making it more known or popular. One term for that kind of moment is tipping point. The online dictionary, Merriam-Webster, defines tipping point as the critical point in a situation, process, or system beyond which a significant and often unstoppable effect or change takes place. The tipping point can also be the time at which a change or an effect cannot be stopped. For example, some scientists believe Earth may have passed the tipping point in global warming. Efforts taken now will not prevent environmental disaster. It is too late to stop the damage. In other words, that ship has sailed. When something reaches a tipping point, it is too late to turn back. It is a point of no return. Here is another definition. The online Cambridge Dictionary defines the tipping point as a time during an activity or process when an important decision has to be made or when a situation changes completely. Used this way, we often say we reach, approach, or near a tipping point. Here are some examples.
In class, the student's anger toward their teacher reached a tipping point. She had again given them a test on a subject she hadn't taught. Prices at the food store are nearing a tipping point. If they go much higher, people will just shop elsewhere.
Malcolm Gladwell wrote about the subject in his book, Tipping Point, published in 2002. He describes tipping point this way. The tipping point is that magic moment when an idea, trend, or social behavior crosses a threshold, tips, and spreads like wildfire. For example, you could say the writer's best-selling second book was the tipping point in her career. Now, everything she publishes is popular. And that's the end of this Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo.
Thank you. The Murders in the Rue Morgue by Edgar Allan Poe. Part 2.
It was in Paris in the summer of 1840 that I met Auguste Dupin. Dupin was a strangely interesting young man with a busy, forceful mind. He seemed to look right through a person and uncover their deepest thoughts. Sometimes Dupin seemed to be not one, but two people. One who coldly put things together, and another who just as coldly took them apart. One morning, in the heat of the summer, Dupin showed me once again his special mental power. We read in the newspaper about a terrible killing. An old woman and her daughter, living alone in an old house in the Rue Morgue, had been killed in the middle of the night. The story in the paper went,
Paris, July 7th, 1840. Early this morning, cries of terror were heard in the western part of the city. They reportedly came from a house on the Rue Morgue, in which the only occupants were a Mrs. L'Espanier and her daughter Camille. Several neighbors and a policeman ran to the house. By the time they reached it, the cries had stopped. They forced the door open. As they entered, they heard two voices, apparently from above. The group searched but found nothing until the fourth floor. There they came to a door locked from the inside. Quickly, they forced it open. Before them was a bloody horror scene. The room was in total disorder, broken chairs and tables, and the mattress pulled from the bed. Blood was everywhere, on the walls, the floor, the bed. A sharp knife lay on the floor in a pool of blood. In front of the fireplace was a clump of long gray hair, also bloodied. It seemed to have been pulled straight out of a head. On the floor were four pieces of gold, an earring, several silver objects, and two bags containing a large amount of money in gold. Clothes had been thrown around the room. A lockbox was found left open with just a few old letters and papers inside. There was no one there, but when the group inspected the fireplace, they discovered another horror. A still warm body had been forced up the chimney. It was the old woman's daughter. There was blood on the face and dark, deep finger marks on the neck, suggesting a strangling. After searching the house thoroughly, the group went outside. They found the body of the old woman behind the building. Her neck had been cut so severely that when they tried to lift the body, the head fell off.
The next day, the newspaper offered to its readers these new facts.
Paris, July 8th, 1840. The police have questioned many people about the vicious murders in the old house on the Rue Morgue, but none of the answers revealed the identity of the killers. Pauline Dubourg, a washwoman, said she has known both of the victims for more than 3 years and washed their clothes. She said, "The two seemed to love each other dearly. They always paid her well. She did not know where their money came from," she said. "She never met anyone in the house. Only the two women lived on the fourth floor." Pierre Moreau, a shopkeeper, said Mrs. L'Espanier had bought food at his shop for almost 4 years. She owned the house and had lived in it for more than 6 years. He never saw anyone enter the door except the old lady and her daughter, and a doctor 8 or 10 times, perhaps. Many other persons, neighbors, said the same thing. Almost no one ever went into the house. Mrs. L'Espanier and her daughter were not often seen. Banker Jules Mignot said that Mrs. L'Espanier had put money in his bank, beginning 8 years before. 3 days before the killings, she withdrew a large amount in gold. A man from the bank carried it to her house for her. Isidore Musée, a policeman, said that he was with the group that first entered the house. While he was going up the stairs, he heard two voices, one low and soft, and one hard, high, and very strange. The voice of someone who was surely not French, the voice of a foreigner, maybe Spanish. It was not a woman's voice, he said, although he could not understand what it said. But the other voice said softly, in French, "My God." Alfonso Garcia, who is Spanish and lives on the Rue Morgue, says he entered the house but did not go up the stairs. A nervous man, he was afraid he might be sick. He heard the voices. He believes the high voice was not that of a Frenchman. Perhaps it was English, but he said he doesn't understand English, so he is not sure. William Byrd, an Englishman who has lived in Paris for 2 years, also entered the house. He said the low voice was that of a Frenchman, he was sure, because he heard it say, in French, "My God." The high voice was very loud, he said. He is sure it was not the voice of an Englishman, nor the voice of a Frenchman. It seemed to be that of an Italian, a language he does not understand. He said it might have been a woman's voice. Mr. Alberto Montani, an Italian, was passing the house at the time of the cries. He said the screams lasted for about 2 minutes. Montani, who speaks Spanish but not French, says that he also heard two voices. He thought both voices were French, but he could not understand any of the words spoken. All who went in the house agreed that the door to the room on the fourth floor was locked from the inside. It was quiet. They saw no one. The windows were closed and locked from the inside. There is only one stairway to the fourth floor. They said that the chimney opening is too small for escape that way. It took 4 or 5 people to pull the daughter's body out of the chimney. It was 4 or 5 minutes from the time they heard the voices to the moment they entered the room. Paul Dumas, a doctor, says that he was called to inspect the bodies soon after they were found. They were in a horrible condition, badly marked and broken. He said only a man could have caused such injury. The daughter had been strangled, he said.
When we had finished reading the newspaper's report of the murders, we were quiet for a while. Dupin had that cold, empty look that I know means his mind is working busily. He asked me what I thought of the crime. I said I considered it a mystery with no answer. But Dupin responded,
"No, no. No, I think you are wrong. A mystery, yes, but there must be an answer. Let us go to the house and see what we can see. There must be an answer. There must."
That's all the time we have for today's show, but join us again tomorrow for another VOA Learning English program. Thanks for listening. I'm Katie Weaver.
And I'm Brian Lynn.